Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
My guest today is a multi-hyphen powerhouse who has developed her passions into credible and successful professional avenues so well, I am in awe of everything she's achieved already. She's a clever, articulate, and dedicated advocate for electric cars, which combined with a lifelong passion for motorsport, has culminated in the birth of the world's first all-electric junior Formula Racing Series. It's called the Software AG ERA Championship, to use its full name, and she is a co-founder and director. While motorsport is a huge part of her life, she grew up close to Silverstone Circuit and has been a marshal, a race director, a commentator, a writer. She is also an accomplished musician and composer. I always research my guests before every show, and this is the first time I've had the pleasure of listening to my guest's work while writing the introduction. I cannot wait to get stuck into today's conversation, so let's get started. My guest today is Beth Georgiou.
And I'm going to check that I've actually said your last name properly, because that's the main thing that I was worried about.
No, it's good. I mean, there's no proper English way to say my surname anyway, so...
When and where did your racing life begin?
It's a big question. I mean, I think my passion started off in touring cars, which is kind of funny, really, considering I'm now really in single-seater world. As you said already, I grew up near Silverstone and went to school really nearby. And sometimes if I wanted a bit of an escape, I used to walk to the edge of the track boundaries from the outside and just kind of watch track days going on from the outside and looking in. And then I think at some point started actually going inside as well and just volunteering for stuff and getting involved with activities. And what started off as just some kind of curiosity became a bit of a hobby and then a passion. And I think it was a lot to do with being a bit of a stubborn teenage girl that wanted to prove herself and seeing that there wasn't so many other women around in the paddock. I was like, well, if I'm there, then there's a woman there. That's kind of, that was really my logic at the time. Like, oh, if I'm there, then at least there's some representation. And it kind of stuck.
Yeah, fair enough. I often feel like that as well. And it's actually really nice when you look around and you're not the only woman anymore.
I know. And it's such a relief nowadays.
Yeah, it is. It's really nice. So would you say you were a fan of motorsport before starting to take some time out watching cars go by, or is it literally because you grew up next to it?
I was definitely a fan. I think I was actually more engaged with things like the BTCC than I was in F1, funnily enough. I was definitely watching F1 and very aware of it, because obviously living near Silverstone, whenever there was a British Grand Prix, especially back in the 90s, it was, you could feel it around everything. And I don't feel like, I don't know what it is. I don't feel like there's that kind of all-encompassing feeling now. Maybe they've streamlined the traffic better, but I remember it pretty much felt like this part of the UK just stopped and went standstill when it was the British Grand Prix. So it was like the helicopters all over the house, could hear it from the house. It was so exciting. But in terms of what I was actually engaging in as a motorsport fan, it was the BTCC, which was messier, a bit more grassroots. It drew me in a way where I felt like I could feel like I belonged in that world. And I loved the fact that with Tin Tops, I could see this is something I can imagine being on the road. And for somebody really, really young, that connection was really exciting because it was like, these are road cars, but really fast. But of course, as I got older and kind of got more interested in the engineering and the technology, I discovered that formula cars were where this cutting edge tech was taking place. So then I began to get more engaged with formula cars, and that was that kind of grew from there. But I think initially as a kid, the touring cars were what drew me in, and I used to buy car magazines and memorize all the stats, which is quite weird, but
it's your passion point. What does it matter? Brilliant. So hang on, tip top racing in the 90s. So Jason Plato, I mean, what are your earliest memories here? Who was racing at the time?
I remember Brands Hatch really vividly in the 90s, and weirdly growing up near Silverstone, I think I would still say that Brands Hatch is my favourite British circuit. And if I was to put ERA on a British circuit, it would definitely be Brands Hatch. And I remember being there in the really early 90s. So I would have been a toddler, and I must have been family friends that had taken me there, and just being overwhelmed. And it wasn't, you know, funnily enough, it wasn't even the driver's presence that almost didn't matter to me. It was just the machinery.
It was the cars. Wow. With British touring car, I completely understand what you mean with it being more relatable. There are brands involved. You know, the cars that you see, you know that you can actually go and buy a car from that same manufacturer. So were you aware of that? Did you grow up wanting to buy a Vauxhall because of VXR, which is the team that I remember, or a Chevrolet, which would have been harder?
I remember when Honda was suddenly really visible in the touring cars, that was all I wanted, was a Honda. And then also I discovered Japanese motorsport as well. So the last combustion car I actually owned was basically because of watching the touring cars. And then I remember in my teens discovering like rally, and then I wanted a Subaru Impreza.
Yes, bright blue.
Yeah, exactly. The ones that were absolutely bright blue, and you'd sometimes see them like going around, you know, they'd have ridiculous paint jobs and be like completely not suitable for the road, and like lowered within an inch of their lives and covered in mud. And yeah, that was the dream. And I think it felt like a level of attainable that obviously when you look at sports cars and formula cars, it's almost alien. When you were a kid, you can't relate it to any kind of silly dreams and fantasies of future car ownership. And I think apparently I was 5 years old when I told my mum I was ready to get my driver's license. So clearly I had some like lofty ambitions as a five-year-old that I was ready to drive. So I had a revelation a few days ago. I've never been karting ever in my life. Like still now.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
I've never karted, and I don't even think I knew karting existed, and I don't come from a motorsport family, so that's probably an important part of it. I mean, I vaguely remember hearing like people at school talking about karting, but I didn't really know it was a thing, and definitely didn't know that karting led to racing drivers racing in Formula One. That was just something that wasn't even on my radar. And I think that it's really strange to look back now, because of course karting is exactly the start of driving school. If you're a racing driver, that's where they all started. But for me, it was not even something I was conscious of. And I don't think I even realized that racing drivers started training when they were like little children. I don't think I even knew about that. And without having that motorsport family and that motorsport background, if you're not from a racing background, it almost seems crazy to parents. And my mum still thinks I'm crazy today for what I do, and I'm not even racing. So I think my perception of motorsport was literally what I had invented in my own head as a small kid. And it's strange when I got older and started to piece the puzzle together and connect the dots.
What a wonderful place to have been, though, as a child, to actually get to have motorsport as your sort of dream world, with no rules and no additional understanding, because it's pretty powerful.
It's crazy when I think about it. And I still remember like having battered copies of, I definitely remember having Top Gear magazine for the road cars, which is quite cringy looking back, and Motorsport magazine, Race Car Engineering, just having battered copies of those that I used to like take into school with me and like show to my friends. And we would just look at the numbers. That's the funny thing. I remember some of my family were really into watching the Formula One, and they were really into the personalities, and this was This would have been, you know, Schumacher and Ferrari, that those kind of days when I was young. And that was all really cool. But I think I was almost too young to get engaged with the human side of it and the drama and the personalities. And I think that came a lot later for me when I suddenly started being like, okay, interested in, you know, the soap opera side of racing, the drama, the people. I just wanted to see the science of it. And that was really what drew me in.
I love it. It's such a different perspective because I came to it much later and it was all about the people. It was completely, it was two things. It was realizing that as a profession, I could be a marketer, a communications person and work outside, but effectively travel the world. That was very much a ding, ding. This is amazing. I'm going after that. And it was the soap opera. I literally called it, this is EastEnders on wheels. It's amazing. To quote a very British reference.
It totally is that. I'm really glad someone says that because, but yeah, I think that was just something that I wasn't aware of. And perhaps it's like an age thing or, you know, it didn't cross my mind. Like, it just felt like that was the grown up stuff, you know, that was so beyond me as a kid. And now when you're older, like, obviously that's kind of the fun part, isn't it? But when I was young, it wasn't even something that factored in. I almost didn't care who was under the helmet. I just wanted to find out more about the cars. In fact, I don't even think it mattered to me so much who won. I wasn't even so drawn into the first place, second place, third place excitement. It was like the race action was more interesting than the outcome.
Yeah, the performance of it, the actual, you know, cars on track. That makes total sense. As a kid, of course, that, you know, that's the obvious bit to get caught up into. Everything else is underneath a layer. So no, it makes sense. Gosh, given all of this, then I really want to ask you my next question, which is, did you choose motorsport or do you feel like it chose you?
I think I chose it because when I went to study, I didn't study anything remotely in the field of motorsport. I did consider studying physics. So I guess that would have brought me vaguely within the wheelhouse, but I ended up studying music. So I didn't study anything to do with motorsport whatsoever. And for the time, the 4 years where I was doing my undergraduate degree, motorsport didn't really factor into my life at all. I stopped doing anything because I was living in London and not really able to travel that much because I was a student. And busy doing 8 hours of music practice a day. So I took kind of a break from really thinking about it at all. And I think the only engagement I had with motorsport was a couple of us used to watch all the F1 at this point. And I'd even disengaged from watching touring cars and things like that because I just simply didn't have the time. But when I graduated, the first thing I did was start working in racing again because I thought, okay, this is something I know and can understand. So it kind of was a really conscious decision. And again, I think it was this stubbornness and being always drawn to things where people didn't expect me to be. It's strange. Sometimes I wonder how I got here for sure. So it's a good question.
I mean, I definitely think we'll have to get into that, especially for everyone listening, because I don't know about you, but I have so many people getting in touch asking me for recommendations for their studies. You know, what should they go and study next? And obviously, you always give as good advice as you can with what you know. But one of the biggest thing that I'm glad you're mentioning is that you don't necessarily have to study something that's relevant to motorsport. You could still end up in it afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? And studying, I don't even know how I feel about studying relevancy. I mean, obviously, if you want to be an engineer, then you should go study engineering. There's some quite clear, obvious choices that need to be made if you have a specific field. But do I believe that studies prepare you for the real world more than experience does? No, I don't think so. I think that if you want to work in motorsport, the best thing is to get out there and get involved, even if it's through volunteering, and to try and experience everything. And when I started having vague ambitions of what I wanted to do on this scale with motorsport, what I spent my time doing was trying to get involved in everything and understand all aspects of the sport, from driving to marshalling to everything. And I think that the most important thing is just to get experience rather than this big, oh, what do I study? It's hard at 18 to make those big decisions and think that they'll influence the rest of your life. And it's also not that simple. So while it's great that people are considering their studies and looking at how that's going to influence them in the future, that maybe there's too much pressure on making sure you make the right study choice and how it will influence your career. Because, I mean, look at me, I've got a music degree, so I didn't have anything less relevant for motorsport, and yet I'm still here. So I think if you're not clearly wanting to do things like engineering, it's so obvious if you want to be an engineer to study engineering, but that's one of the few examples I can think of in our sport where there's this clear pathway, and most people I know in the sport now haven't come to it through this like little tidy journey. It's been messy, you know.
Absolutely, definitely. My gosh, I think before I got to Formula One, I think I did every single potential aspect of motorsport as far as a comms person is concerned. You know, working for sponsors, working for my own series, so relating to you a lot with what you're going through at the moment, working for agencies, you know, I think I did everything. I think by the time I got to be the role that I was initially targeting, which was to be a comms person within a Formula One team, I had literally experienced every single aspect of communication within motorsport at all levels before I got there. And that's what made me good, not my degree. My degree was a 20-year-old trying to get through university. I dread to think, I'd hate to reread anything I've written when I was there. I'm sure I'd be really cringe.
Yeah, that should be a podcast all on itself, but I think it would be a podcast where you'd need a fair amount of alcohol first.
I do still have my dissertation, actually, which was on Formula One, and I don't want to open it. So we've spoken about your studies. Let's talk about what you're currently doing, because it's incredibly exciting. And I'd just like to read something that you wrote on LinkedIn recently, as obviously I researched what you'd done in the last few months, just to get a sense and be able to do this podcast a bit better than just asking your question out cold. And it really resonated with what I know of you and how I've experienced you, obviously, in the few times that we've met. We've been very lucky to have met a few times thanks to the FIA ETCR and ERA, which are both on the same weekend. You wrote, "This is what it means to bring something new to motorsport in the world of 2022. Being a disruptor was never meant to be easy, and the journey is only at the beginning. You have such a huge job currently with what you're trying to achieve. Tell us a little bit more about your role and the series, because I know how passionate you are about it as well. And I think everybody needs to know that."
I'm glad I actually expressed myself fairly accurately on LinkedIn. It's been a really hard year for the industry. When we first set out with ERA, it was a few years ago now. And I guess none of us could have predicted what would happen globally. It's funny because people ask for the origin story, and like, really, ERA was the classic pub chat. A bunch of people in motorsport, some of them fully involved now with ERA, some of them just like nicely on the sidelines in their kind of regular motorsport career, that were kind of involved in the like the embryonic stage. So the people that are involved in it day to day, yes, like we are obviously kind of instrumental in the start of it, but it was a lot of voices at the beginning that brought this here, and that's kind of important to know. But it was chat that went, "Oh yeah, but we could actually try something here." I think that's the beauty of it, really, is that it wasn't something manufactured by a big organization. It really was a bunch of people that were just kind of passionate about doing something, and we're still surprised that we're here. Even though we're only at the start, really, and we've still got a lot more to do to prove the series and to prove ourselves, the fact that we're here, sometimes it makes me laugh because I can't quite believe it. Can't quite believe it. Yeah, and I don't know, maybe that's not a good thing to share about the origin, but I think our whole thing is always being honest about all of the challenges, all of the good things, what our aims are. It's sort of one of our company policies now at this point is just complete transparency, really. And that's the truth of it. We had some ideas. They've certainly evolved a lot. That's another thing about being sort of a startup organization, is that we have flexibility and we can do stuff. And I think that's something that is often missing in our sport, because it's a sport that's got so many years of heritage behind it. And so much tradition, so much bureaucracy, so many rules. And that's also what makes it great, and what means we've got massive, amazing things that take place. But when you have big organizations that have gone for a long time, it's difficult to make quick changes because you've normally got to go through like 100 people and get 100 different approvals. So we were in this position where we were small and agile. And that means that when I think we launched our first car in 2019 in Silverstone, I think it was in August 2019, that was our kind of first ever prototype. The cars massively changed because we then had a pandemic, and we could have gone, okay, well, this is it then, because we're not going racing anytime soon. The cost of production is going up. The logistics have gone wild. Nothing makes sense anymore. The industry is going to struggle. But instead, we used that time to acquire an innovation grant and developed our battery further, started doing a lot more things in-house, and maybe it wasn't the utmost best thing we could have done with that time, who knows, because it's hard to predict. But we used that time in a productive way that meant that when we could then reveal our car, the final version that we're racing with now, we'd made some years of progress that probably if we'd have started racing sooner and there'd been no pandemic, it wouldn't have happened. It's been a lot about adaptability the last few years, and I think also we saw that electric motorsport, we were all passionate about. There was loads of reasons why we were all passionate about electric motorsport. But what we were also passionate about was using this shift to make other changes as well. And we saw this as an opportunity to solve, or not solve, other problems. I think that would be, it would be big to say we're solving problems, but there's a lot of shift in mentality within our sport and how we can make our sport more relevant to the world we live in today. And we felt like actually at a junior level, where things are more affordable and more accessible, if we could bring in some changes at that level, then those changes will filter up. Whereas I think quite typically we look at how to filter changes from the top down, and in some situations that can be really difficult. So, you know, we saw that as an opportunity to address some things that we didn't like about our sport. Maybe that's not the right way to say it, but things that we felt like needed improve in order to bring more people into the sport and welcome more people that maybe didn't looked at motorsport and thought, this isn't for me. I think it's just been crazy to launch anything new at this time. And people have been really patient with us, which is great, because pretty much every issue that could have been thrown at us has been thrown at us. And we're just like busy adapting and dodging and changing to fit with this world. And I think we're now in a position where we can firmly say that we're here and we're racing and we have everything we need now to make this happen. We've come out really strong at the end of it.
Yeah, you're progressing hugely. For the benefit of people who might not know about ERA very well, it's a Formula 4 car. It's a Formula 4 chassis adapted, or it existed already, and it's been taken and fitted so that it's an electric Formula car. And the idea of it is to fill the bridge between electric karting and more established series like Formula E and EGCR. So the sort of already running electric series that have got people there and drivers there already, electric karting, which has become more and more successful. And then you've got this massive void and you're trying to help people bridge that gap, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so the chassis is the Japanese Formula 4 chassis by Dome. It's actually the first time that chassis has been used in Europe. They were really keen to work on an electrification project, so it made a lot of sense to work with them. Then we obviously build the back end of the car, we build the powertrain, and then the human machine interface, so like the brains of the car. We also take it kind of a step further. So although we're using a Formula 4 chassis, we don't really consider ourselves like an electric Formula 4. It's more about the Formula 4 being what we saw as the most efficient platform for what we wanted to achieve. So the car doesn't weigh a lot more than a Formula 4 car. I think it's maybe 5% heavier. But obviously, when you consider a Formula 4 car, fuels, and it pretty much balances out. And also importantly was we wanted to keep the cost down. And this is one of the biggest challenges when building electric cars at the moment is, and a lot of people focus on like the super, hyper, mega, ultra fastest thing. And that's, you know, that's cool. It brings a lot of press. It's really exciting. But actually, one of the more difficult things is, how do we build something that doesn't cost the earth? And that was our kind of brief the whole time, was we need to build something that's attainable so that we can target people from all kind of backgrounds. We can encourage companies to get involved with the car and bring in their technology. And a lot of these companies were also startups, so didn't have a big budget to be involved in top level things. So that was really where our challenge was. But despite that, we still made our car very tech heavy, and like, cutting edge technology is one of the most important things we're doing, and it's how we're really engaging in our USP within the industry. So all our cars are an IoT device, an Internet of Things device, which means every car is its own Wi-Fi hotspot, which is not normal, especially not in junior formula levels of motorsport. I mean, this has got endless possibilities, but at the moment, what this means is we're sending data in real time directly back to our pit lane, to our engineers. We're able to feed data to our drivers. And ultimately, it means we'll be able to feed live data to our fans as well. And the platform that you view this data on is totally customizable. So if you're an engineer and you're specifically focused on one thing, you can say, OK, I want to view this data, this data, this data. I like this one as a graph. I like this one as a bar chart. This is how I want my data. And it's quite revolutionary, and especially in a junior formula series. For the drivers, it's so valuable to be able to be corrected and understand things in real time, because normally it's a case of showing them videos later and being like, oh yeah, you remember when you went wrong here on turn 7? And they're like, yeah, they don't remember. And also, I mean, learning to drive an electric car for an inexperienced driver is very different, and we're learning that. We weren't expecting how different it would be. And you see, like, if we put a 16-year-old driver in the car and we put regenerative braking on the car, they're fine. You put a really experienced driver with a lot of titles and a lot of wins behind their name, and you put 80% regen on, they're going into the gravel. So we're learning alongside our drivers and learning what their needs are, and being able to have access to this data is really exciting. And as a series, we are an open book with our data, which means that if you drive with us, you are willing that all drivers' data will be shared within other drivers. So all our cars are the same. We can prove it. We've got the data to prove it. So if this driver is faster than you and you want to know why, we'll take the fastest driver's data and show you, look, this is the footwork. This is what's happening. This is how you can improve. It's obviously supposed to be fiercely competitive, but also we want to nurture kind of a family community with our drivers, and they're all learning from each other, because they are with us intended to be at the start of their career, and we want to give them all the tools so that they can go into the world and make it in ETCR or Formula E or wherever it is they choose to go next. And so we think that for those drivers, the transparency and learning from one another is kind of the best way to go.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's a real academy element to what you're doing, isn't it? And I was actually looking a bit more on the website. I didn't realize, but like, you can actually book to drive the cars as well. Like, if I wanted to come and experience it, I can actually book and go find you and drive it.
And it's a totally new thing. In fact, it started in September. So our partner company, ERA Racing School. So there's a bunch of our cars that live permanently year round now at Circuit Zolder, which is another great thing, is that we don't have noise issues with our cars. So racing on circuits was really important for us to help, especially circuits that have a lot of noise issues. We have a lot of that in the UK as well. Zolder is a great example of this in Belgium. I think they can only run a few weekends making noise a year, and the rest of the time they have to be creative and run cycling and things like that on the circuit. But we don't want these circuits to go. We're motorsport people. We want them to survive as a business. And if people keep building holiday homes next to circuits and then calling to complain about the noise, then we're going to lose all of these places. So it's a really great opportunity. I mean, also in the future, it means we could do night races. It's an accessible car in terms of performance. It's not designed to be the fastest car in the world. It's designed to fit this space in motorsport, which means that we can open that car up for other people to drive and to have an experience. So if you maybe are just interested in electric racing and want to do a few laps, we now have little racing experience courses where anybody can go and go to Circuit Zolder and get a chance to drive the car on track. And if it's your first time ever in a single seater car and the first time ever, they'll take you in the sim first, so you learn the track a little bit, and then the car is software adjustable, so we can make the car a bit less aggressive for your first time round, so that you feel totally confident when we do turn the power up that you know the car, you know the track. And there's never been an opportunity, as far as I know yet, for people that aren't pro racing drivers to get behind the wheel of an electric race car, because at the moment you've got only this top tier of racing, and it's not like the average person is going to get behind the wheel of an ETCR car as much as we would like to. We've got something that's really accessible and possible and attainable. So that's kind of another really important element for us, is to make something that everybody can ultimately enjoy from a fan perspective, from a driving perspective, whatever. If you want to come and get in the car, then you can from September this year.
That's amazing. I'm really excited about that. And also, having just recently been to Zolder for the first time, it's a brilliant place. What a nice track. What a nice region of the world. Yeah, it's lovely. So everybody go. Putting the spotlight back on you a little bit more. Having said everything we've just said and understanding how big your role is, because I think effectively you're doing everything. You're just trying to get those cars on track and everybody mucks in. Would you say there's a misconception around your job? You know, what is your mum and dad or your friends, you know, what do they assume that is completely wrong about your job? And don't say champagne, because we know everyone thinks we drink champagne all day.
I know. I wish that was true. I think that I think people just have no idea. The thing is, when you see a Formula car, people get really excited. Nothing excites people like seeing a Formula car, because it is just so alien and so evocative to see a Formula car. So that's generally the things people focus on. People don't really understand what I do, full stop, and I'm not great at filling them in. So normally, I think everyone thinks that we have this really glamorous life of traveling to racetracks. And then you're like, well, actually, you travel to a racetrack, but you don't see anything else except for the racetrack. So I think that's a huge misconception, is people are like, oh, you're traveling a lot. You must see all of these exciting things. You must get to be a tourist. And it's like, no, you don't get any of that. That coupled with like the lack of sleep that you have on a race weekend, which I think you're all pretty familiar with. The race weekends are great, but when you're in them, it can also be hell, right? Because you're knackered, you're trying to do your job when you're running at like 50% brain power. When I knew that I wanted to run a series, maybe not, I wasn't really expecting to have my own series. I didn't think that was really something that was possible. But when I knew my ambition was to run a team or to run a series, I spent a lot of weekends for like 2 or 3 years marshalling. The reason I did that was, like I think I said before, I wanted to get kind of a holistic understanding of motorsport. And the marshals are so consistent, such an intrinsic part of our sport, but so often forgotten. It felt like something where I really needed to go and experience that. And I did. I went nearly every weekend for 2 years, on top of doing my 9-to-5 job running Formula Student. So it was a lot. It really was an eye-opener for me. I think that was the greatest lesson I learned in our sport, was doing that role, because there's also way more about marshalling than people think. Even people in the sport, I think they think they just kind of stand on the sidelines and wave flags, but you can be a marshal that runs the garages, you can be a marshal that's weighing the cars, you can almost have kind of scrutineering roles. I mean, I also did some stewarding as well, which is then totally different, because your job is basically penalizing drivers and telling drivers off all weekend and making a bunch of enemies. So I became really confident with telling people off and analyzing footage of racing deciding what was racing incidents and what was worth penalties. I learned about the legal processes that, you know, it actually in motorsport, I think people don't realize that decisions can go to court. That's the thing. And police can be involved in certain incidents. That I think people forget that it's, you know, it's a sport, but it's within a real world framework. And I marshaled some events, and especially the most dangerous events to marshal. And marshals are really, they put their lives at danger, and they're not paid for it, which is crazy. They're probably the most important people in our sport that makes a lot of money. And some of the most important people in it are not paid for it. And yet they turn up every week. So it's working with them was inspirational. But the most dangerous marshal experience I had weren't at the big events where you see the drama on TV and you're like, oh, there was a near miss with F1 at the marshal. It's actually in the grassroots events. And that's because normally less people want to go marshal them. So there's been times where I was running marshal posts by myself because it's not a glamorous, exciting event. So there's not enough of us. We're trying to cover an event in a rain and you've just got cars coming at you, like just crashing into the wall with inexperienced drivers, like race after race after race. And you're dealing with car after car after car just coming off. And sometimes they're on TV. And I think that for my friends and family was when they were like, actually, you're putting yourself in a lot of danger. Like, we've seen you with a car on fire, like coming at you, like, this is crazy. What are you doing? And that was when I think people realized that they're, you know, I think we think about how the drivers put themselves at danger, but the people on the track also do as well. And that was a real eye opener for my friends and family, because they saw some things on television where they were like, oh my God, you put yourself in real danger. And they were like, are you sure that this is what you should be doing? And I was like, well, honestly, I don't know, because there's been some, you know, there's some crazy weekends and you sometimes really question it yourself, but then you go back again. So I guess it is what you're supposed to be doing.
I think it's the passion, isn't it? I think you're absolutely right to do that role, knowing the physicality of it as well and the dangers and not being paid for it. You know you're there because you're passionate about it.
Officials and marshals, often you get like the negative comments, of course, because fans don't really appreciate what they're doing and they see it as interrupting the race they're watching. So I think it was so valuable for me to know that, because any race weekend that I do, I'm so appreciative of every single person on that track. I know how hard they've worked and how dedicated they are. They're possibly way more dedicated than a lot of people that are, you know, in their paid job, to be honest, because they're really doing it on top of their normal lives. And I think it really turned on my head the entire perception of how the great machine that is motorsport worked, and turned my perception of officials and volunteers completely around. And I think that has made me the leader in ERA that I am today is very much shaped by that understanding. So I'm grateful I took that time to kind of understand everything from those roles.
How do you define success for yourself? I know you've had a lot of challenges in the way. I feel like getting the cars on track for a race was probably a championship winning worthy moment. But yeah, tell me.
Yeah, it's really weird because people keep asking me about that. Look, the backstory of this year is post-pandemic. We've obviously gone back to normal, but it hasn't gone back to normal. Everything is delayed. Everything's more expensive. Logistics are a nightmare. So our season that was all nicely planned out towards the end of the pandemic didn't go how we thought timeline-wise. It was really nothing that we could control as well. And that's the worst, because if it's things that impact you that you could have foreseen, then at least you can learn from it. But how am I supposed to learn from parts of the cars being delayed by 6 months? I mean, even things like steering wheels were difficult to get this year. And also we've been busy going through our FIA approval to be an international series, which is a massive deal. So it's just been crazy. I mean, it's fantastic that we managed to achieve that. And I'm so proud and also so grateful to everybody within the FIA that helped us get there when we've been dealing with all of these global issues and have been patient with us, because obviously the whole industry has been struggling with these issues. But because we're new, we have so much more to prove. We're not a brand. We're not like a famous brand. Everyone's obviously going to question us. And when the world is throwing problems at you, you constantly think, well, God, everyone out there is going to think it's us that's the problem and not the world, because they don't know. And also because we were new, we didn't have backup things. So we didn't have old parts of cars we could put together to get our cars working. Everything was brand new, and we were just playing the waiting game. So when we actually finally got to have our first race and make history, and unplanned, it turned out to be in our home circuit next to our workshop, it was like, it was this crazy kind of like universe moment. And it was not perfect racing. It was not maybe what we expected, but it was great racing. It was really great, even though not all of the cars made it onto the track and not all of the drivers made it there. We had super close racing. Everybody was in the crowds was elated, was going crazy, because we had like 17, 18 overtakes between P1 and P2. We had a lot of drama. We were showing like the power of racing when every car is identical, like how close that can look. It was incredible. And you can see, I think, if you watch our Eurosport footage, which is also available on our YouTube, you can see our team going absolutely wild, which is amazing. But also alongside our team was the whole team for ETCR. It was all our other friends in the paddock. They were all there, like so hopeful for us and so excited to see us finally reach this milestone. That was being in the paddock with people supporting us was probably what motivated our team and got us through this year. Because when you're working so hard and things aren't going your way, it can be really difficult to stay motivated. But other people being there and cheering our success was great. But for me personally, the funny thing is, like my team were going crazy, elated, all really excited. And afterwards, everyone was like, oh my God, you've done it. You've made history. How do you feel? And I was like, I don't really know. I was like a little bit emotionless. And now we're over a month on, and I still haven't really had that kind of like wow moment yet. And I was talking to my my mum yesterday about the year, and she was like, but you've had this amazing success, how do you feel about it? And I was like, well, I don't feel like I've had the success yet. I was like, maybe next year I'll feel like I've had the success. So I'm definitely very tough on myself. A lot of us are really guilty of that. When I think about what we managed to achieve this year, despite all of the adversity, it's crazy. And it's been sheer passion from my whole team that's made that possible. And that is incredible and something I'm so, so proud of. But for me, I just feel like this is only the start. So I'm not celebrating yet, if you know what I mean.
Well, you're focused on the to-do list. You know what else needs to be done. That's the problem. If you manage to have some time off at some point to let it sink in and just kind of take a step back, it will hit you and it's going to feel huge. I really wish that that happens, because you absolutely deserve to feel it. But I know exactly what you mean. You have a huge project on your hands, and just because you got the cars on track and managed to have the very first race doesn't mean that the job's finished and that's what you're focused on. It's normal.
The funny thing is, there's a lot of really embarrassing YouTube Eurosport footage of our emotions. But it was I was on the pit wall by the start finish line, and my team were all watching it on the live feed and had the timings up, and I was kind of glancing at it, but mainly just watching the cars every time they came past and what else was going on the track. I was feeling so sick in my stomach that I could barely watch what was going on, because it's crazy. I've seen insane things happening on track, but when it's your own cars, like, it just feels so different when you've put in all that time. I was like, it just felt like nothing I could describe before with racing. So only afterwards did I then watch the full race once it had happened on repeat and watch every corner and analyze everything. But at the time, I just kind of had to disengage a little bit, because otherwise I couldn't cope emotionally.
Well, it's your cars, the sense of responsibility attached to it. Again, I'm putting myself in your shoes, but please correct me. But my feeling at that point would have been, can I possibly muster enough energy to hold every single car together so that everything goes absolutely perfect and nobody has any issue?
We already lost one car that didn't get off the line at the start of the race for the formation lap. And that was already like, oh my God. And you know what's so annoying about that is that issue was with that car was with the 12 volt battery. Nothing to do with it being an electric car. We had a failure in the 12 volt battery, which you get in combustion cars. And I'm like, oh, this is so annoying. And also it's a battery issue. So everyone's going to go, oh, it's because it's electric. And it's like, well, no, it's the small battery. In fact, there's two 12 volt batteries in our cars because you've got the main one and then the auxiliary 12 volt. But like, such a stupid reason to ruin somebody's race. And I was really gutted that that driver didn't get to drive as well. And then you feel responsibility. It was such a stupid, tiny issue. And of course, we've learned from that as well. But in the franticness and the fact that it was new, things like that are going to happen. And it was next year, obviously, we've got all of these things that we know can go wrong. And we've got a lot more time. But when you're kind of dealing with borrowed time and trying to get everything ready to a deadline that became unrealistic thanks to a global situation, those things happen. But we showed, even with not so many cars on track, that the racing next year is going to be so dramatic and exciting. So the feedback we've had since that has been incredible. The people watching the live stream, the people that then watched the highlights on Eurosport, the thing was, is everybody loved the racing. That's been one thing that's really stuck with me, is like, we showed great racing, and that's something that we always wanted to achieve, and that we wanted, you know, why are we here if we're not showing great racing? So the fact that we achieved that is really exciting. And despite all of the other things that were on the side, and that we weren't running full power and all of this, and that we had plenty of issues that we're totally honest about, because why would we not be? This has been really hard. But we've proved that the racing is good. So with every day that we have to kind of fine tune, and now actually take that step back and say, okay, we're not rushing now with everything being delayed, and we've got time to prepare for our next events this year and for next year. Hey, look, this one race was great. So imagine how good it's going to be next.
It's going to be amazing. I'm so excited for what's coming next. Well, we're getting close to the end of the podcast, and I wanted to ask you, for anybody listening who dreams of following your specific path in motorsport, what advice would you give them?
You need to just take every opportunity. Also, be realistic about the tough times. I would love to tell people that this is easy and wonderful, and every day you're going to be dancing around, drinking champagne and rainbows. But in reality, it's just relentless hard work, relentless rejection. So brace yourself, but never feel like you don't have a place in this sport, or that this sport doesn't welcome you. I think that's the most important thing that we want to change with ERA. Don't look at motorsport and think, this isn't for me. If you're passionate about it, if you're passionate enough, then there is place for you in racing. So if you're tough enough to deal with the hard side, if you're passionate enough about it to deal with the difficulties, then like, go and like, make yourself a place at the table, like bring a chair to the table and sit down. I think there's so many people that look at it and go, oh, it's not for me. And especially as a woman in motorsport, obviously we're in a position where things are looking a lot better. But it's still an important topic we need to talk about, because we're not there yet. There's still gender pay gap issues. We still don't have women drivers in a lot of series. Don't look at that and be put off, because we'll never make a change. So make sure that you, like, if there's not space for you, make space. if there's not a series for you to run, then make your own racing series. If I could talk to my younger self, I would say, like, be realistic about how difficult this is going to be. And I guess you would say the same, because it's easy to look from the outside and be like, oh yeah, travel and glamour and all of this, but it's just damn hard work. And you're going to be working on little sleep. The racing seasons can be crazy intense. Like, our racing season was quite short, and will always be reasonably short in Europe. But we had back-to-back weekends this year. And that is, everyone will tell you that works in motorsport, it's such a hard work. But you'll also meet people that motivate you every day. And the friends that you make in the paddock, the relationships you build in the paddock, will be like nothing else you've ever experienced, because it's so intense. But yeah, make that seat at the table. That's the most important advice. I don't know if I have anything else useful to say.
No, I like it. Get a chair. Get a chair.
I'm paraphrasing another famous quote, but I think that's so important. I think it's so easy for people to look and say, this is not for me. Especially, we talk about women in motorsport, but there's also the wealth gap in motorsport. And that's something we're really trying to address with ERA is it's traditionally a sport for the wealthy. And we want to find ways to change that because you're just excluding so many people on the basis of not being able to afford to participate or being able to even afford to pay for view for watching the races if you're behind a paywall. And for some people, even that kind of investment is too much, especially in the world we're living in today where people are struggling to pay their bills. They're not going to then pay to watch a race. So that's something I'm really passionate about is people not being excluded from our sport based on any circumstance. If I could wave a magic wand and change one thing in our sport, it would just be that. It would be that our sport is accessible to everyone, no matter who you are.
Wise, wise words. And finally, genuinely so happy to ask you this, Beth. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I can't wait to get racing again. We needed some valuable time to be testing and to kind of recover from the drama that was this year, make plans and see what we're doing. But now that we have got our cars ready and waiting for people to come and drive them, and that we're not starting our season on the back foot, I'm excited for the rest of this year, but I'm really, really excited for next year because we've now seen what our racing is going to look like. And we've proven that our cars, they're the same. So when we get those 10 drivers behind the wheel, we're going to have a dramatic season. And I think that's something that for a lot of people is often missing in racing now. It's something that was so common in the 90s. You'd have this dramatic season, but quite often now you can predict season endings very early on, even in racing series. And I think what we're going to be doing will turn all of that on its head. And I can't tell you what will happen next year. I don't know. But I think prepare for some really, really dramatic racing. That's what I'm most looking forward to.
Excellent. I cannot wait. I'm going to be there supporting as much as I can. It's been a privilege to be able to watch the very first race on site in Zolder, and I wish you every success. Beth, thank you so much for speaking to me today. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you, Beth, for sharing your story. I could have chatted to her for hours. Beth is so passionate about what she's doing and has achieved so much already. I know I'll be cheering her on for years to come, I can tell. As always, I'd like to thank the producer of this show, Pressplay Productions. The really very, very good Tabatha is the one who turns our brilliant chats into the very, very nicely edited podcast that you listen to each week, so thank you. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe via your favourite podcast platform. Leave a review if you can. Tell your friends, post about it on social media. Every single little bit helps. It's bringing new people to the podcast, and I really hope that we can continue to grow the audience so that we can continue to make it. As you know, I read every message, every mentioned, and I absolutely love it. And feel free to send me some questions if you'd like, if you want anything answered. You can get in touch with me directly via the Instagram account Pandea, which is Pandea. There's a link in the show notes via which you can support the podcast directly if you'd like to. I basically use a lot of coffee to make this show, and every little bit helps. Thank you very much for listening, and speak to you next week.